Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. In this programme, I talk to Paul Weller. Welcome to Master Tapes and to Paul Weller playing live for our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. In this programme, I'll be taking Paul back to 1981 and the making of The Gift, the final album from his band The Jam. It was a record that included tracks such as Precious, Carnation, Ghosts and A Town Called Malice. Paul Weller, welcome to Master Tapes.
Thank you.
It's almost exactly 30 years since The Jam split up. 11th of December 1982 was the final gig. But The Gift had come out early in the year in 1982. Did you know it was the last record when you were making it?
I had a sort of inkling to sort of move on, you know, but I think the decision was after that, really, after we finished the record, you know.
Yeah, and just to set it in context, the sixth record in 6 years. So this is an incredibly prolific band, but that's the way that things were done back in that day.
Well, yeah, I mean, you put a record out every year and you toured it and then you went back in the studio and made another one. I mean, that was, you know, that's what you did. It helped you refine your craft, you know, and find yourself as a writer and as a band. And it kept you on your toes. You were only as good as your last record.
And it didn't feel like a treadmill then, because that's the way it was. There was an expectation, it was another year, there would be another album.
I don't know if I felt it was like a treadmill. It was a lot of pressure because I was the sort of pretty much the sole writer in the band. But that's just what people did. That's what bands did then.
And it was a band that you'd started, even though there were six albums in 6 years, starting with the first one in the city in 1977. The band had been going since school. I mean, you'd been in the Jam, in effect, since you were 14. So there was no choice. You were always going to be a musician. That was always the aim.
Yeah, that was always the aim, yeah. The only thing I was ever interested in, really. I mean, a fella called Steve Brooks started it when we were 14. Me and Steve did our first gig at that age as well.
As a duo.
Yeah. Playing anything, had sort of three chords, really, you know,
rock and roll,
country and western. And we used to write our own songs, you know, sort of Beatlesque, to say the least, really. But
do you remember the very first song you wrote?
Vaguely, you know, don't ask me to play it, you know, because I really, you wouldn't want to hear
you
it
anticipated
anyway.
That,
but,
didn't you?
But, you know, we used to write all the time, you know, and we'd learn off each other. We'd try and learn off records and we'd find a new chord and that would set us off.
Yeah. Your father, John, was always regarded as the fourth member of the Jam. So,
yeah.
And he was always pushing you from an early age. He was never the kind of dad who would say, when are you going to get the real job?
No, not at all, no, because he worked on the building and he'd seen real jobs, you know, and what they were like. And he saw some talent in me. I was passionate about music. How much talent I actually had was another matter, really. He saw something in me, I think. And he always pushed us, you know, he always encouraged us. And whenever we start to sort of flag or not getting anywhere, he'd always kind of spur us on, you know.
And your mum as well. There was a real team Weller pushing
you
back.
Yeah, it was, I suppose, yeah. I think also the fact I didn't come from an academic background, right? I mean, my dad was a builder, like I said. My mum used to clean people's houses. So it wasn't like it's like, you should go to college, son. It wasn't an option, really. Not that I'd want to go anyway. So I think they were happy to see me doing something that I loved, you know, something that I was really into.
And your dad was the manager right from the outset. He was the one who was hustling for the gigs. And your mum was always there cheering you along then?
Well, you know, when we started off, we just used to play, like, social clubs and workingmen's clubs around our area, in the Surrey area. So it was a bit of a sort of Saturday night out for us all anyway. We'd all get on the lash. And it was fun, you know, it was a laugh as well, you know.
And fast forward through the success of The Jam, because it happened very quickly. You were signed in 77 and then you were seen as part of the punk movement. But then you were always a part as a band. It was always a very different sounding band in attitude, look, lyrically, to a lot of your contemporaries.
Yeah, it was. We kind of already had our look. But the punk thing definitely influenced me. Punk was important for people of my age because it was our time, you know. We were too young to be part of the 60s scene. And there was nothing really much in the 70s, you know, maybe Boland and Bowie in the early 70s, you know. But by the mid-70s, it was really dull, you know. There was no one really kind of singing for us and representing us. So the first time I saw the Sex Pistols, for instance, you know, was in 76. And I just thought, this is it. This is our moment. You know, it was our generation's time, you know.
It lit the fuse and you were on.
Yeah, the catalyst for it, I think.
And it changed the sound of the Jam, because you had been playing R&B covers, rock and roll covers, and then you started increasingly writing your own material.
Yeah, I mean, I was already writing, but it shaped how I started to think about writing, songwriting, especially here in the Clash, and they were trying to write songs about what was going on and kind of social, political songs. And it influenced me, you know.
And we take you to 1981, to the making of The Gift, the album that we're talking about today in this programme, because The Jam were the biggest band in the country at the time.
Yeah.
You'd had succession of singles going straight in at number one, going underground and Start, and there was a real sense of fervour around the band. But you were only 24 years old. I mean, looking back, incredibly young. There was a lot of pressure to be bearing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was incredible pressure, yeah. But I don't like to moan about it, because for the 10 years prior to that, that's all I ever dreamt of doing or getting to, you know. But it was a lot of pressure, you know. There were things about, you know, well, it's, you know, use the word, but stardom, if you like, you know, that I didn't really like. But, you know, the positive things far outweigh any of that, you know, because it was so exciting as well. And I was the right age to be doing that, you know.
And hailed as a spokesman for a generation. I mean, there was an expectation that whatever was happening in the world, Paul Weller would provide a quote.
I don't know how that happened. I don't know, you know. I mean, I think my songs, I mean, I could barely string a sentence together, you know. The lyrics, anyway, connected with people, I think. I like to think, anyway. Well, I know they did. But it was a bit heavy for me, that. I didn't thought I'd not really cut out for this, you know. I'm just a song and dance man, as Bob Dylan once said, you know. That's quite the truth. But, you know, I was trying to write about myself, but I was trying to write about my generation, you know, no pun intended. But I think also, because I wrote coming from a little suburban town, it was slightly different as well, you know. It wasn't like I was a hip city kid, you know. It was quite the opposite, I suppose, really. So songs like Saturday's Kids, you know, really kind of rung a bell, I think, with a lot of people around the country, because not everywhere's a big city, you know. There's lots of little pockets of suburbia. And
that's off the Setting Suns album. That's about the kids on a Saturday afternoon hanging out.
It was about all my mates I grew up with, you know.
That's reportage, really, that song, isn't it? And had you always done that? Because it's quite an unusual thing. As you say, you're not academic, and when people were expecting you to be pronouncing on issues of the day, it seemed very hard for you to talk about it, and yet you were creating these character studies of life around you. Had you always done that? Had you always written, even if they weren't lyrics? Had you always been writing stories and poetry as a kid?
No, not particularly, no. I'd always written songs from the time I was 14, from the time I learnt three chords, in fact. And that's what I wanted to do in life. I wanted to be a songwriter. But I don't know if I had any other kind of ambitions beyond that, you know. But I think sometimes the good side of success is that it spurs you on, you know. People start taking you seriously, and sometimes that can be a very rewarding and positive thing, you know, because it kind of pushes you into being better at what you do, you know.
Yeah.
And I think around the time of, probably it started with All My Cons, which was like our third album, but I think by the time I did Setting Suns, I was kind of writing more, you know, almost like sort of prose, I suppose you'd call it in some ways. I guess it started really with Down in the Tube Station, you know, which I, at first wasn't really a song or a lyric as such, it was just a kind of poem thing, you know.
Which is a story that plays
which is
out.
A little story, yeah. And almost like a little sort of TV drama or
like
something.
Like a play for
you know?
Today.
Yeah.
And back to The Gift, because you head into the studio in 1981 as the biggest band in the country, and you've had a series of hits, and I guess there's a bit of money behind you. And you head into Air Studios, which was owned by George Martin at the time, and it's at Oxford Circus. I mean, so literally in central London, looking down on the city. So did that help shape the sound and the lyrics that you're writing, do you think? Do you regard it as a particularly urban album?
I suppose it did in some ways, you know. We were kind of right in the centre of it. But then, you know, if I look at something like A Town Called Malice, those images to me make me think of Woking, really. But I think it was exciting. I'm sure there's, the element of just looking down and seeing all the people milling around, and, you know, you're kind of in this sort of sanctuary of the studio, and it's quite a weird sort of feeling. But I think it probably added to the energy of the record.
And would you have had the songs already written when you headed into the studio with your bandmates, Rick Buckler and Bruce Foxton, and give them to them and say, these are the songs that we're going to be playing? Or were the songs worked up in the studio?
It's a bit of both, really. There were some songs which I'd written beforehand and I'd demoed on my own. And then there's other things we kind of worked up, you know, had a vague idea or a chord sequence or maybe a few scraps of lyrics. And we would kind of jam on the ideas and it would kind of take shape from that.
Which would have been the first song, do you think, that was recorded or ready?
I'm not sure, you know. I think probably things like Carnation and Just Who Is the 5 o'clock Hero, I'd definitely written those at home.
Both of those, almost character study. Well, Just Who Is the 5 o'clock Hero is a character study.
Well, it was kind of written about me dad, really, in lots of ways, you know. And the opening line is, "Hello, darling, I'm home again," you know, which I kind of imagine like you see in those sort of crappy 70s middle-class sitcoms with, like, "Hello, darling, I'm home again." You know.
Terry and June.
Yeah. And so he was just like he'd been sandblasted when he got home, you know, covered in cement and stuff. because he'd been working all down the building. He was a hod carrier for most of his life, and which is tough work, you know. I don't even know if they exist anymore, really. Probably, luckily for a lot of people.
Hello, darling, I'm home again. Covered in shit, headaches and pains. Too knackered to think, so give me time to come round. Just give me the liver and read to the beeping down.
So I kind of like the irony of that, really. You know?
And do you remember, was that a strong image in your memory of him arriving home?
Yeah.
Too knackered to think, so give me time to come round.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a little bit of poetic license, because, you know, he always had a smile on his face, and I could hear his whistling down the funny little alleyway between our funny little house in Woking. So he was just glad to be home, and he was always, you know, a very sort of loving person, you know, positive person.
So that starts, that's the inspirational
but
spark.
He was the 5 o'clock hero, you know, that's when he knocked off work, and he was one who provided the food and clothes for us, you know.
Yeah.
So he was our hero, really.
Do the lyrics themselves determine the rhythm of the song?
Yeah, because there's lots of lines in the song, right, that are kind of in a, about being musical, but it's in a kind of triplet timing. That sort of thing, right? So that kind of decided the rhythm pattern.
Right.
From this wind I've seen the world pass. From dawn to dusk I've heard the last laugh, laughter. Seen enough tears wash away this stream. I've heard wedding bells chime and a funeral march. When it's one life finishes, the other one starts. From this wind I've seen the world pass. From dawn to dusk I've heard the last laugh, laughter. Seen enough tears wash away this street.
Sorry. Would half it do? Just do as a 2.5 hero or something like that.
From this wind I've seen the whole world pass. From dawn to dusk I've heard the last laugh, laughter. Seen enough tears, I'm off.
I mean, there are so many chords in it, aren't there? There's key changes and chord changes.
Yeah.
Do you write songs in that way still, or is...
I don't know how to do it anymore. You know, I wish I could, you know. It's like, I think it's also the thing when it's born out of naivety, or, you know, you don't know what you're doing, really. It's kind of, that sounds nice, I'll follow that.
Mm. And Town Called Malice, I mean, a lot of people still regard that as one of the best songs that you've ever written. I mean, absolutely beautifully observed series of vignettes of, as you say, of suburban life rather than urban life. And it's about the everyday worries and the pressures. I mean, what prompted that? Because that was just the way that you were looking at Britain in 1981, then.
Well, that's the way Britain was at that time, I thought, anyway. And the images of rows and rows of empty milk float stand dying in the dairy yard, you know, was me thinking about the dairy yard in Woking. Even though we led a very good lifestyle because we were successful, but at the same time, we were also travelling around the country all the time as well. So you could kind of see the effects of poverty and obviously the effects of Thatcherism and... industry shut down, you know, and no prospects for a lot of people. A lot of young kids either getting into drugs or joining the army. It's just depressing, man, you know.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about that song, I mean, if you look at earlier songs like The Eton Rifles, and there's a comic aspect to that song.
Yeah.
About this almost mini-class war battle being played out outside the gates of Eton School as the right-to-work marches go past.
Yeah.
And then you had Going Underground, which, again, another... protest song in a way, but that's quite an angry song.
Mm.
And when you get to Town Called Malice, there's a sad, mournful quality to that. And yet...
Well, I don't know. No, I don't know if I'm not sure if I'd agree with that. I think the lyrics just tell it like it is, you know. But there's always that kind of let-up at the end of each verse. But I sooner put some joy back in, you know. And that's the kind of let-up, really, that people need.
And it was the first one that a lot of people heard. I think it was released as a single before the album came out.
Yeah.
And you'd been playing it live. And that signalled the change in the sound of the Jam, which previously had had kind of a really dense, raw sound. And you hear that on Going Underground and Eton Rifles and tracks like that. And with the Gift album... soul and funk were influencing a lot of what was going on musically in the studio. So was that reflecting what you were listening to at the time?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We had a DJ with us called A.D. Crowdstall. He was our DJ on tour, and he used to just sort of turn me on to loads and loads of records and give me bundles of records to take home and listen to. And I can remember going to Air Studios almost every morning. I'd always get in there early because I lived in London. The others came from out of town. And I'd have like a little record session before we started every morning, you know. Just buzzing off these records I'd never heard before.
And that music you were listening to was then feeding into the...
filtered through in what we did that day, really.
So you hear in Town Called Malice that bass line, that Supremes Can't Hurry Love bass line.
And yeah.
And you were upfront about those influences.
Well, yeah, I mean, it looks like it's sort of thing you can deny, is it, really? You know? It's like when people go on about start, you know, so it does sound a bit like tax money. It sounds exactly like tax money. But it worked, you know.
But that's a song which is driven by that bass line. But would you have... You had the words, and it reads almost like a poem, that song. So possibly that was already written before
I probably had a lot of the verses. I might have finished off a couple of middle, like a middle eight or something like that. But I had most of the verses. I didn't necessarily have a song for them as such. I think we just jammed on that riff that day, you know.
But you would be doing that on... Because you're sitting here at the moment with your acoustic guitar. But at home, when you're looking at lyrics in front of you, you would be just working your way through chords and then trying to find chords that fit the theme of the song.
Yeah. Almost all the songs I wrote were wrote at home from that time anyway. And around that time, I'd moved to a little flat in Pimlico, and it was a very small flat, so I used to kind of go in this funny little hallway. As you walked in the front door, there's not even a hallway, it's like a little kind of, you know, recess thing. Yeah. And I was sat by the front door writing these songs, you know, which just seems a bit strange, really.
I mean, you're the biggest pop star in the country at the time. I mean, that's quite incredible. Did the neighbours hear the songs being written?
There wasn't that sort of money, you know, you know. It wasn't the big bucks it is, or has been, not so much now, but it was later on. And I wasn't particularly materially minded, you know. Mm. I was happy with what I got. I think I got £100 a week, and it was so on, and that's fine with me. But it worked, didn't it? You know, it worked in that small little space to write these claustrophobic songs.
And you'd always write on an acoustic guitar then?
Yeah. And I used to have an old Ovation, which I've still got, which is sort of like, it's been splintered and smashed over the years, but I've still got it anyway. And I wrote almost everything from, like, probably 1980 onwards on that guitar.
Yeah. And do you still have the lyrics, the original lyrics that you were writing?
No, I used to have this ritual, which I did up until recent years, where I would rip up or burn my books. I'd always have a book of lyrics, and once I'd finished the record, I'd destroy them, so they were kind of, that's it, gone, you know. It was kind of like a, you know, next step now, let's all start again, it's a fresh canvas.
That's ruthless creativity, though, isn't it?
I mean,
driving yourself
it now, man, yeah.
It'd be worth a bit, actually.
Or something, there you go.
So none of those lyrics exist. I mean, you would literally just destroy them, and that set the tone for the rest of the career, because, I mean, you've always done that. It's always been about looking forward. Don't rest on your laurels. Mm. I mean, despite the fact we're looking back 30 years now, and increasingly you've been doing that, have you finally been able to kind of embrace your past and your legacy?
Well,
the way
I suppose
that you couldn't
do before. But I mean, that only comes from being older, from getting old, you know. I'm comfortable with that now. You know, there was a period of time I would have shunned that, but I don't mind it now. But I'm also at that age where it's like, well, what does it matter? It's fine, you know.
Well, take us back to sitting in that little recess in the flat, writing Town Called Malice. Just could you play us Town Called Malice now, just to give a sense of what possibly it would have sounded like when it was first written, when it first emerged?
Well, like I said, the day we would have been jamming on that riff on the, you know, and then over the top of that I would get this. It's like a D chord without being getting too muso, but it's like playing a D. But I just sort of changed it a little bit. So it's very kind of up positive sort of sounding thing, you know. And then it goes all sour. You better start deep enough to die tonight, 'cause it's the one you'll never know. Quit my father, run away. Because those rosy days are few. This is quite a sort of melancholy sounding, but very, very melodic as well.
Right.
You know, like that.
And you're patching in the words there, so they're not they don't automatically spring back. I mean, do you know all the words off by heart?
If I really, really concentrated, I guess I would do. Yeah. But I haven't. It's because I haven't played it for a few weeks. I'm just like that, you know. If I'd been playing it yesterday, I'd remember the words, but I haven't played it for a few months, so it's kind of gone for a bit.
There are a lot of songs to remember on
there. There is a lot of songs, yeah.
So you take that version, that sketched out version.
But that's how it would have been. Yeah. It would just be me going, you know, that's how I write songs, you know, and all of a sudden the words start to form.
Right.
Or maybe I've got something pre-written that I think, oh, that would fit that. But most of the time, it's been me making stupid sounds, really. You know, until something comes, really.
Did you know immediately that you're onto something special, that this was going to be a play? You did?
Yeah, not about this was a number one record, but it was like, this is a great record, because everyone we played to, we had friends drop by, and everyone's just buzzing on it.
And it's a song about the hardships of life, of the big decisions. But, I mean, in the studio, a lot of the big decisions were on your shoulders. You were writing the songs, you were the front man, you were the spokesman for the generation. As you say, you were already feeling a bit confined by the limitations of the band. And now it's been reported that you had a bit of a breakdown in the studio at that time.
Yeah,
what happened?
I'm not sure about that. I think I've just been out too many nights in a row, that's all. I think it gets slightly, somewhat exaggerated. But I've been caning it, you know. I've been working hard. I've been writing and trying to get this album together with, you know, obviously with everyone else as well. So I stopped for a bit, you know. I just thought, right, I'm going to take a vow of abstinence for a bit and clear my head. which is what I did, you know.
And did that influence the sound of the music? Because there's a kind of sense of clarity on the record. Lyrically, even though there's a kind of melancholy aspect of Town Called Malice, a lot of the lyrics on the album, you think of the title track, Gotta Keep Moving, Gotta Keep Moving. There's a track called Running on the Spot where you're urging the people around you, your peers, your contemporaries, to change their lives around and to take control of their situation.
Well, I thought Running on the Spot for me was like, what have we achieved? That was kind of more for me. I wonder what me and my generation had actually achieved, you know.
Was it a slap in the face for punk because of that line about stop revelling in rejection?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I still get annoyed even to this day, you know, when people talk about punk as the ground zero and all that stuff. Because it was great, you know, for about a year or something, and then that was it. But, you know, like any sort of scene, you've got to take what you believed in and what you thought were the good points in it, and you take it on and you make it something else, which is exactly what we did, you know.
Did the album come together fairly quickly in the studio once you'd got the songs sketched out and written? Was it recorded fairly quickly?
Well, I think it was done in sort of two chunks. We started it before Christmas 81, and then we finished off in the new year. But I think it was fairly easy, really. There's a good mood amongst people, I think.
And I think at the time there was the complexity emerging in the songs as well. And one of the most striking songs on the album is Ghosts, the second song. I mean, it's a very fragile and haunting song, and it's about people living up to their potential, needing to live up to their potential.
Yeah.
Any idea how you wrote that? Can you cast your mind back? Do you know how it came about?
It started with a little riff, you know. Quite minimalist, you know. I wanted to try and key like that. I can't remember where it goes after that. So I probably just had that, you know.
Yeah.
And then Bruce and Rick just sort of jammed along to it, really. But I like it. It's really sparse and there's not too much going on, really. It's just bass, drums and guitar. And the horns are on it.
There's some lovely lines on that song as well. I mean, it spreads some loving all around. Old-fashioned causes like that still stand. And again, it's a rejection of that sort of nihilistic sensibility that punk had brought in.
I was trying to write about what was going on around me, but I was obviously trying to put something positive back into it as well, you know.
It's almost like a rallying call, isn't it? Or imploring people to do better.
Just to see their own potential. That was the idea behind it, really.
Yeah. And it finishes with that line, lift up your lonely heart and walk right on through.
Yeah,
I mean, were you...
I'm not sure about that one, but yeah.
Why?
I think it's just me trying to be sort of, you know, a little bit too classical, really. But, you know, some people like it, I don't know.
Was it about yourself as well, to an extent, do you think? Ghosts?
Well, yeah, I think, probably, yeah. It wasn't a biographical song in any way, but, I mean, I could probably see bits of myself in lots of my songs, really, you know.
Yeah, and you were playing the riff there, but, I mean, it's not a song that you've ever... I don't think you've played it since, have you, since the jam?
Well, it's boring to even talk about this, I guess, but it's too high for me now.
Yeah.
The years have taken their toll, you know. But if you change the key, you mess the song up, and some songs are like that.
But it's one you're particularly proud of, I guess, isn't it? I mean, it's one that many jam fans cite as one of the finest. It was never a single, it was there on the album, but it's one which is always regarded as one of your classics.
Well, I like it a lot, yeah. I don't know if it's one of my classics for me personally, but I'm glad that people think that.
And the other song on the album that is held with that sort of affection is one that you're going to play us out with in this edition of the programme, and that's a song called Carnation. Again, it's quite a bleak song, isn't it? If you gave me a fresh carnation, I would only crush its tender petals. In a way, the song's a riddle, isn't it? Which only resolves itself at the end of the end of the last verse.
Well, I thought because, probably especially at that time, people think, oh, you know, this is Weller writing about himself. It's not about me, it's about you, in fact, you know. I like the twist at the end of it that it's got, you know.
If you're wondering by now who I am, look no further than the mirror. Because, how does it go?
Can't remember.
You better check, because you're going to be singing it.
This is one I have played recently as well, which is even more sort of scary.
Paul, we've taken you back 30 years to the making of this record. You said at the beginning that when you set out to make the record, you had no idea that it would be the last jam record.
No, I don't think so, no. I mean, I wasn't happy. I was a little bit sort of, you know, kind of getting that way, but I think it was... After we finished the record, I went away for a few weeks on holiday. And that was kind of when I thought, I've just finally had enough of this, I want to move on. It was the first proper holiday I've had, I think, really.
Ever?
I think so. As I remember, unless you count tours, you know, which it can be sort of holidays in some ways. But I'd only had, like, sort of a few days in my mum and dad's caravan in Selsey, you know. And I think I was 24 at that time. And it was kind of, you know, I'd spent all my teenagehood in this band... And I wanted to go off and sort of see who else I could be, you know, not only musically, but, I mean, the personality as well.
Was it difficult to tell them, to say, look, this is all over?
Yeah,
or were you
awful,
just determined?
Yeah. It was horrible, yeah. You know, I first told my dad when I was our manager, I can't repeat on Radio 4 what he said, but he wasn't happy anyway. He just thought I was bonkers, you know. But then, so he said, well, you've got to tell the others, you know, which I kind of dreaded. But it's like any relationship, really. It's always hard to say to someone, look, I'm not happy, I want to leave. You know, it's awful for anyone, really. It's a horrible situation. But the weird thing was, on that very last tour, we were playing great and we all seemed to be smiling on stage again, you know. For me, anyway, right, the weight was lifted. It was like, thank God, you know, I'm going to move on to have a little bit of breathing space and a bit of time on my own.
Paul Weller, thanks for taking us back 30 years to the making of The Gift. That's it for this part of the programme, the A-side, if you like. As Paul gets ready to play us out, let me remind you that in the second part of this edition of Master Tapes, the B-side, our audience will be posing the questions. You can hear that next Monday night at 11 o'clock, and you'll be able to hear both programmes at the Master Tapes pages on the Radio 4 website, along with exclusive live versions of some of the songs we've been discussing in this programme, including this one, Carnation, by Paul Weller.
If you gave me a fresh carnation, I would only crush his tender petals. With me I'll have no escape. At the same time there'll be nowhere to settle. I trample down all life in my wake.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.